Welcome to episode 7 of the African Photography Safaris podcast. Today, we're going to talk about choosing a photography safari. It's a lot to talk about. In fact, it's a huge subject, so we've made it into a two-parter. Firstly, we'll look at what we believe are the most important things to consider, and then we'll follow that up in episode 8 with some of the logistical aspects which need just as much attention. As always, we have some questions to the podcast, one about wildlife photography with blood, guts and gore, and another about our reference to honey badger impersonators in episode 6. We're also going to talk about the importance of backups as well, some news about some rather alarming reports on the decline of birds of prey in Africa.
Now then, this episode is the first time we are recording for YouTube. So if you're also seeing us on YouTube, then the camera setups and sound sync plus the editing all came together and worked absolutely fine. And I shall pat myself on the back and bask in technological glory. However, if something didn't work and we are not yet available on YouTube, then obviously Khalil must have done something wrong.
Blame the techie.
Any matter, we are still on Spotify, Amazon, Apple, Audible, Google Podcasts, plus our website, of course, at africanphotographysafaris.com. And just for the avoidance of doubt, yes, it is Khalil who is the technical whiz and not me.
Chief nerd, you mean? Yeah, I'm the one with the monitor tan who sits for days in front of a screen in a darkened room after the recording. I'm only let out once I've finished. Before we move on to our main topic, we have to talk again about Kisaru. We've mentioned her quite a lot in the podcast, and with good reason. Female cheetah Kisaru and her numerous gorgeous cubs have provided our photography safari guests and us with so many incredible photo opportunities during memorable encounters with her. We've spoken about her in the context of memorable photography moments, and also she featured heavily in our discussion about naming animals and whether the practice is too anthropomorphic.
We've seen and photographed her with different litters of cubs. We've seen her bring down absolutely formidable prey, male impalas, Grant's gazelles, you know, with these huge defensive horns. But we have some sad news. At some point around the 20th or 21st of January, Kisaru's body was found being scavenged by hyenas. It's thought she may have died protecting the cubs against lionesses, but we don't know that for sure. That's just the likelihood. It was difficult to hear this news, and yes, I know that is a very anthropomorphic viewpoint.
Yeah, it's hard not to be affected by the death of such an iconic animal that, you know, we've spent a hell of a lot of time with. And yeah, maybe it is anthropomorphic, but Kisaru had such a major impact on the many visitors who, you know, watched and photographed it.
Yeah, and wild animals in places like the Mara, Kruger, Serengeti, etc., they will die as a result of predation or other natural causes, and then they will be scavenged. That is life in these ecosystems. The reason I say I'm sad is not because I feel grief or anything like that, but it's because she was an incredibly successful mother cheetah, and she birthed and raised so many cubs, and in doing so significantly defied normal cheetah mortality rates. Her care and attention to protecting her cubs, which we witnessed, and her hunting prowess, was amazing to see, and I think she made a really sort of positive difference to very, very fragile cheetah numbers, especially in the protected areas.
Yeah. Watching her hunt and bring up several litters of cubs was a real privilege, and hopefully her cubs, who are now adults, will continue her success.
I do hope so. I mean, Kisaru herself, she came from good genes. She was the daughter of another very, very famous cheetah, Amani. Yeah. And I think she may have been the granddaughter of another famous cheetah called Saba, who we
that rings a bell,
think
actually.
We actually photographed.
No, we haven't
but
seen
we did any. See Amani.
Yeah.
Anyway, moving on. We have made a few tweaks here and there to our website. That's a little bit of news. We've brought it up to date. We've added some photographs from 2023. And also a lovely photo wall, which is an ongoing collection of images we take behind the scenes. And we also have a TikTok channel.
Yeah, indeed, we have a TikTok channel. It's in its infancy at the minute, but, you know, we aim to build on that when we return to Africa this year. Speaking of which, all our flights and the camp are booked for the Great Migration trip to Kenya this August and September. We're running a couple of weeks there this year, so Alan and I will be at Matikoko Camp in Lemek, the Masai Mara, between the 27th of August and 9th of September with our lovely guests. Can't wait to be back, you know, especially for this extended stay. That area never gets old. I mean, the camp, the people, you know, especially the incredible wildlife, is just amazing. If you'd like to join us for all or part of that trip, we have 7, 11 and 15 night options this year. And you can find all those details at africanphotographysafaris.com.
And for the trips we run with our friends and partners at Penda Photo Tours, there is one space left for Botswana, one for Timbavati in August, and we've got some good availability for southern Tanzania in October.
Is it time for beer?
Debat upside down.
Actually, no.
No,
right, okay. So what happened? I had to look this up because they were just over themselves. So what is they actually turn themselves so that they don't shit on themselves, and also they shit while they're flying.
But they're made upside down. And they urinate when they're flying.
Yeah.
They're not shit upside down.
Can you imagine they would just be covered in shit all the time?
Well, it depends.
Be constantly.
Anyway. Right, yeah.
Well, that's my impression anyway. But yeah, they apparently they turn around before crapping on themselves. But
find a bat to watch having a shit. Right, so let's move on. Our main topic is part one of choosing wildlife photography safari. It's not as straightforward as many would believe. There are lots of things which need to be considered and quite a few significant pitfalls to avoid too. As a photographer, the most crucial thing is to choose a bespoke photographer's safari over what we would perhaps call a general off-the-shelf tourist safari.
Yeah, I mean, we would say that anyway, but, you know, there's a good reason for that. I've had countless people over the years ask me, what's the cheapest or the best way of doing a safari in Africa? That I think, you know, the thing is, I'm always honest and I say, well, what do you want to get out of the safari? Do you want to go for a few days and see the amazing animals and then maybe go off to the beach and continue the holiday there, which is a completely valid type of holiday. That's absolutely fine. It's just not what we look for. It's just what I think most people think of when they think of a safari. They go to see the animals. They go to maybe photograph them on a phone or a small camera, but it's not really what we need. But their interest in the animals is very different from ours on a specific photography holiday. As photographers, we need something more. We don't just want to see the wildlife and take a phone photo and move on. You know, there's nothing wrong with that, but we need more time, more consideration, more options, more expertise. On a photo safari, we need lots of time with the animals to get the right composition, the right light, the right behavior. You know, we might sit for half an hour or even an hour waiting for a lion to yawn, show those canines and carnassial shear, or an elephant to fling mud over its back, or a beautifully colored lilac-breasted roller taking off from a tree for a flight shot. You know, a normal tourist safari wouldn't bother with that, and nor should they, but a photo safari should. We need time to consider camera settings and to experiment to get the best shots. We need our Maasai wildlife guides on site to help us get the positions and keep moving around if necessary. For all this, it's important to choose carefully a trip that has the right relationship with the people on the ground who instinctively understand the difference between a sightseeing trip and a photography trip. And obviously, as experienced wildlife photographers with many years of visiting Africa, Alan and I add value by helping with any aspect of photography, whether that's camera settings, composition, or just general photo chat and field craft to do with animal behaviour. I think that's that sense of camaraderie also naturally comes about when you've got a bunch of like-minded people together who are interested in wildlife photography.
Yeah, sharing and feeding off each other's enthusiasm and ideas, it's something that's really lovely to see that happening. But, you know, when I've been speaking at various photography and wildlife events, I've spoken to a lot of people who were really quite disappointed with the safari. And a lot of this is a result of not choosing a dedicated photographer's trip or not doing careful research. And it has to be said, they've had a pretty unrealistic low budget as well. And it really is a shame to hear stories like this because a little bit of research can make a huge amount of difference. So a couple of actual examples. I know of somebody, or I met somebody, who chose Kruger National Park. Now, the clue's in the name. It's a national government reserve. And the thing is, you're restricted to roads. And while they saw various animals, they were very sort of disappointed in the distance, which meant they weren't really photographable. Great for seeing animals, not great for photography. Now, I've also spoken to a couple who chose a lodge or camp, I can't remember where, but the first safari drives didn't actually leave until 10 a.m. in the morning.
And 10?
They went, yeah. And they were never actually out past 5 p.m. Now, this is absolutely ridiculous for a photography safari, you know, especially when you want to be out there you know, in the early hours to see the animal activity. And in contrast, we're often leaving in the morning under the cover of darkness. You know, we're out there before sunrise. We're getting to somewhere for the sunrise. And we're returning or stopping for breakfast or brunch by sort of 10 a.m. We're not leaving the camp or lodge then.
Yeah, absolutely. Coffee and a biscuit in the darkness before heading out to hunt for that glorious golden light, you know, at the beginning of the day. That's just magic, that. And going out at 10 a.m. is just anathema. It's just, that does not compute for me. Animals are more active at these times too, you know, the early morning and, you know, in the evenings as well. But, you know, in the mornings when we set out, we'll often see hippos returning from grazing on the plains to get back into the safety of the water before the sun gets really, really hot. Or we'll get news of a lion kill that's happened overnight. You know, if you wait till 10 a.m. to head out, you'd rarely, if ever, see these things. It's interesting, I watched a video recently of a photographer called Jared Polin, who, you know, you might know him as Frono's Photo on YouTube. His main remit's sports photography, but he put up a video the other day about an African safari he went on where they were trying to get a shot of an elephant with Mount Kilimanjaro behind it. What really struck me about that trip was that they couldn't leave the vehicle tracks, and he found it really difficult trying to position himself in the vehicle where he needed to be. I'm sure it was a very well-run trip, but there are just some areas that just don't allow you to go off-road. You know, in the end, he did get some fantastic shots, but when we're out in the conservancies in the Maasai Mara, we can responsibly off-road. We're unrestricted like that. The tourist numbers are a lot lower too, you know, than, say, the National Reserve, and you can usually enjoy more time getting better shots because of the privileged access in those areas.
Another example was a lady I spoke to at the Park Cameras wildlife photography event when I was speaking there in September. She and her husband chose a sort of off-the-shelf safari, and they ended up in a 9-seater vehicle with 7 other guests. This meant they spent a lot of time sat in the middle with guests either side. It's really bad for photography, especially with a longer lens, and forget easy access to a camera bag with a spare body, lenses, monopod. Even if you do get a side seat, if you're chucking a big lens about, you know, you're really not going to be popular with the other people around you.
Yeah, we limit the number of people in each vehicle, so everybody always gets a window seat. And that reminds me of going to Disney World in Florida a few years ago with my youngest daughter. We were there for a dancing competition, and I thought, why not, you know, go and do the Disney experience in Animal Kingdom. And to be honest, it was just comical. It was just ridiculous. There were 32 of us crammed into this vehicle. At
one
point, I think it might as well have been, because there was another one behind us. You know, it was just typical Disney. You know, at one point we saw this pretty cheesed off looking leopard up next to the fence. It was ridiculous, you know, and that was the highlight. Yeah. I just couldn't help giggling all the way around, wishing I was in Africa instead.
Because we've been spoiled by the reality.
We have. Yeah, on that point, I just don't go to zoos anymore It's just pointless. No. Okay, it's not pointless, but, you know, when you've seen a giraffe in the wild and then you go and see one.
It's hard to get enthusiastic about it, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
It's a shame, but, you know.
Even on a purely aesthetic point as well, you know, seeing animals in an enclosure just looks shit compared to on the savannah, you know. Anyway, so once you've picked a specific photo safari operator, you'll have to decide where and when you want to visit. There are lots of factors which will influence this. We believe the main considerations are species and geography. So there are, of course, other elements such as culture, economy, currency values, ease of travel, time to travel, for example. And we'll cover some of those in more logistical details in episode 8. The main thing to think about here are, what key species do you want to see and photograph? And is this something that's important to you or not? If so, it needs careful consideration. A lot of people consider the big five, that is lion, leopard, cape buffalo, African elephant and rhino, to be the main draw. But, you know, let's not forget there's a cast of other iconic species that we really want to see and photograph too. Cheetahs, hippos, giraffes, wild dogs and zebras. You know, perhaps thousands amongst many more thousands of wildebeests as the wildebeesties.
Gnu. This is going to be on Gnu Tube.
Oh, God. Yeah. As the Great Migration traverses the Masai Mara and Serengeti ecosystem. People get a bit confused about this. The Masai Mara is kind of the upper bit of the Tanzanian Serengeti. It's the same thing, basically. There's actually more in the Serengeti than there is in the Masai Mara, but it's one big ecosystem that the animals travel around. Maybe it's primates that you're interested in, and that's an important thing to you, and that would be a different place and a different time.
Yeah, I think there's quite a lot of misunderstanding about what animals you will see in different habitats. It's definitely not a case of you go to sub-Saharan Africa and you see, you will see everything, because you will not.
Yeah, the classic thing I always get is, did you see tigers? It's
exactly.
You don't see tigers in Africa.
Bears, camels.
Yeah. Red squirrels.
Puffins. So, you know, while we've seen lions and elephants everywhere we've been, so, you know, Kenya, Botswana, Uganda, Zimbabwe, South Africa, we will see lions and elephants. Other species will vary in numbers and in their presence. So a few examples, I'm going to rattle through this. We see and photograph leopards successfully in Kenya, but I've seen more individuals more regularly in Timbavati and Savi Sands, which is in South Africa. There are two species of rhino to see, the black and the white rhino. You could see black rhino in the main national reserve of the Masai Mara and in the Mara Triangle, but not so much in the private conservancies. White rhino can be numerous in parts of South Africa, and there are black rhino there too. However, we can see white rhino in specific rhino sanctuary areas like the Old Choro Rhino Sanctuary in the Masai Mara. Some areas of Botswana do not have rhino. It's a shame, but sadly the investment required to sort of address and deter the criminality around poaching is just too much of a major issue.
Actually, that reminds me of that time we were in the Mara, and there was a black rhino that had come up from further south, I think.
Yes.
It was.
Yeah.
And it basically had an armed guard that travelled with it. Mm-hmm. All around. Of course, yeah. It wasn't publicised at the time.
No.
Safe to say now. Mm-hmm. But the investment in having to follow a rhino mm-hmm. around and make sure it's not poached is massive.
It's incredible. And I understand why they sort of herd them back to a more manageable area for the security.
It's safer for them,
you know. And it's a shame, but
it is,
you know, it's a sad fact of life at the moment. I've never seen wild dogs in the Masai Mara in Kenya. Mm. They are there. They have been tracked and seen in Enon Kishu and in Old Choro conservancies, but they're very, very elusive. I have photographed them in Savi Sands and Timbavati. We see Cape buffalo, often vast herds on the savannah of the Mara, and also in Timbavati, Kruger, Savi Sands, albeit in smaller herds. Some areas of Botswana don't have buffalo, something to do with farming and bovine TB. And on cheetahs, we've had fantastic success, as we spoke about quite a lot, with cheetah in the Mara. I have seen cheetahs, but only once in South Africa and once in Botswana, albeit in numbers.
I don't think I saw any cheetahs in Zimbabwe and Botswana at all.
No, it's strange.
I'm sure they're there,
how it sort of works. So then there's animals like Thompson's gazelles, Grant's gazelles. They're more endemic to sort of Kenya and Tanzania. Impala, pretty much everywhere that I've been. Kudu, Nyala, they're very much South Africa and Botswana. And then springbok, for example, South Africa, Namibia and Botswana. And there's lots more little sort of antelopes, differences between the habitats and ecosystems in different areas of sub-Saharan Africa. But what we then have to think about are the birds. Perhaps a certain bird species is on your list, but, you know, that's another massive consideration for choosing a time and a location.
Yeah, birds are incredibly abundant in Africa and diverse across all the usual safari destinations. But if, for example, you're specifically after flamingos, those massive, herds, but obviously not flocks, you don't want the Masai Mara, you might want Lake Nakuru or somewhere else, for example. If you want gorillas and chimps, it would be worth looking into Uganda and Rwanda. I ran a trip to Uganda with Penda a few years ago, and the primates were incredible. But there were definitely fewer numbers of big cats, for example, in Queen Elizabeth National Park. If you're after the sheer abundance and breadth of species, I'd probably recommend Kenya, South Africa, Tanzania, Botswana. You know, we could go on, but I think you get the idea. It's very important to think about your key species, if you have one. If you don't, then, you know, fine, just go to Kenya. They're all there, because it really will influence your shortlist of locations. You also need to look at habitat. Do you want to experience the vast open savannas of the Masai Mara? Perhaps the beautiful rocky outcrops and colourful mapani trees of Tuli Block in Botswana. Zimbabwe's Matopos is a special place I've been to, which has some fantastic rock formations. The areas of bushveld in the Kruger are a bit more dense with foliage, which can sometimes facilitate in getting closer to photograph more variations of bird life, for example. The windy, impenetrable forest of Uganda for gorillas, or Queen Elizabeth National Park also in Uganda for tree-climbing lions. Yes, they do exist. Then there's the time you visit. You won't see the vast herds of wildebeest and zebra of the Great Migration in the Masai Mara in March, for example. At that time, most of the vast hordes of animals will be in Tanzania. You know, that's what I was saying earlier on, that it's part of the same ecosystem. They'll just be down in the south at that time. For Kenya, the Great Migration happens maybe sometime between July and October. Of course, you can't predict it exactly. We tend to plan our visits for August and September for that reason. It's bang in the middle of that likelihood. We've always seen it, but, you know, you just it's a natural phenomenon. You just can't guarantee these things. Climate is also an important issue. In South Africa, for example, the winter is beautiful, very dry, with chilly mornings and a general warm day, you know, all throughout. Summer's very hot, humid, and potentially very wet, which can affect travel around reserves when riverbeds are in full flow, which would otherwise be very dry and drivable during the winter. Similarly, the rainy season in the Masai Mara around March to May can massively change the habitat in terms of greenery. That classic dry, pale grass of Kenya's savannah is like that in the drier months when the migration comes through. It's green earlier in the year.
So it's also very important to research how a camp or a lodge works. And I feel a bit of a rant coming on now, actually. this is mainly about their priorities. For example, I am aware of people's experiences where camps or lodges gave the evening dinner service a priority over the guests being out at sunset enjoying the most incredible moments of the day. The guides, unfortunately, sometimes not the places where we visit, I must add. This is other experiences that I've heard people relaying to me. So sometimes they've had guides who are under enormous pressure to get their guests back in time so they have time to get dressed for service in the restaurant. It's, you know, it's just so far from ideal for photographers. And it's really not great for anybody, I think, with a sort of love of the wilderness and wildlife as their priority. And that's why they're there, you know. You know, it's just bullshit, man. You know?
Elephant bullshit or buffalo bullshit?
Both. Yeah. Both. Yeah, in copious quantities. There's a guy called Dave Vardy, who was the founder of Londolozi Reserve in South Africa. And he wrote a fantastic book called The Full Circle. And within this book, which we could review, actually, this book for the podcast, maybe, there's a couple of paragraphs about how some safari camps and lodges he found lost their true purpose. And it's something, there's a couple of paragraphs which really sort of resonated with me. He writes about some lodges, and I'm going to give a couple of quotes here, that have been replaced by hoteliers and professional guides. The result has been that much of the spontaneity of the bush safari lodge experience has been replaced by the more staid professionalism found in a hotel.
Yeah.
Also, a second quote was that the driving force of our bush experience was the energy of nature and the beauty of wildlife. To us, cuisine, the size of the room and the intriguing decor were all subordinate to the adventure. We were never in danger of allowing a hotel manager's tail become so important that it wagged the wildlife dog. We lived in a beautiful and exciting corner of the world, and we wanted to share the gift of nature that was our inheritance. Our purpose was to involve guests in the endless fascination of nature, to provide the opportunity for our guests to learn and always to ensure that they had fun.
Poetic, that.
It's quite poignant, isn't it, really?
It is, yeah. I have to say, I like a little bit of rustic charm.
Yeah.
You know, not that sort of poncing about in, you know, They're dressing up for dinner and all that sort of thing. The idea of getting dressed to go to dinner on safari is totally anathema to me.
But, you know, there's rustic charm is one thing and there's comfort is one thing, but, you know, you could be staying at the most palatial luxury lodge that you can imagine. But I think if somebody values a marble bath suite or a nicely ruffled crimson flounce around the bread around the bedspread, it's a bit of an exaggeration. You laugh, but the point is, if somebody values fixtures and fittings in a lodge more than being out in amongst the action in one of the greatest wildlife ecosystems on the planet, witnessing and enjoying the wildlife, then what is the actual point of being on a wildlife photography safari? There's plenty of luxury hotels in the capital cities around the world that you can go and enjoy. Personally, I know everybody who I've been to Africa with, including your good self, you know, I love every moment on safari. Yeah. The photography, the wildlife, of course, but I love the informality and the laughs that we have. That moment where we're out, photography as the sun drops behind the horizon, incredible shapes of the trees, and if you look at giraffes wandering past, elephants silhouetted against the sky, and then the African night sky, man, a clear night, the amazing stars, the Milky Way visible to the naked eye.
Magic.
It is, and, you know, I love coming back to the lodge or camp in the dark, quite literally, just sling my camera bag on my bed, head straight out to the warmth of the roaring fire, a few beers, glass of wine, gin or whatever, getting dressed for dinner, man, there's no way, there's absolutely no way I'm losing out on photography time, right? Or I'm going to lose out on chatting with our guests because we have to get bedecked in a pair of beige flannel slacks and a crisp white shirt and put my camel cashmere evening jacket on to sit formally at a table in a restaurant. No, it's not why I'm here. What next? I'm going to put a pithy helmet on as well. I mean,
plus force.
Come on.
It's probably a good job, really. I mean, even if I did own a crisp white shirt, can you imagine within seconds it would be covered in soup?
Yeah, just safari dinner medals. You know, but as you know, it's become a bit of a joke, but I do pride myself at being first at that fire every night. And make sure that, you know, our guests come down, the glasses are full, just sort of chatting, enthusing about the day's experiences, listening to their thoughts and their questions that they've, you know, perhaps sort of come across throughout the day. And it's not just us and our guests. As we know, when we've been in the Mara and Matty Coco with Moses, Boston and James, you know, the Maasai lads and the lasses, they'll join us. And, you know, same when I was in South Africa, Safari Elvis, our guides, and Murray, they would too. As in Botswana, Joe and Julie, together, you know, we'll just have a little bit of a chat. We'll listen to what's going on around us. We'll have a beer. We'll take in the sound of the wild and, you know, in the evening and make friends, which ultimately, you know, lasts a lifetime. It's just incredible. Shining that torch into the darkness of the night, trying to guess who's, you know, what do those reflecting eyes, who do they belong to?
It's me.
It's Khalil coming from his tent. Yeah. get the UV torch out as well, something I like to do, particularly in South Africa, and look for scorpions too. Just take it all in, you know. Sometimes there's just no words, and imagine missing out on that because the hotel manager wants to serve dinner at 6 p.m.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
It's just
Yeah. I love all the wildlife sounds as well, you know, the roaring lions and startled zebras. One of my favourite noises in the African bush at night is the hyena calls. Whoop, whoop, whoop. That's just so evocative. It's fantastic. It's soundtrack to the bush. Having said that, you know, we said that about the dinner. In terms of the food available on safari, and this has been an unexpected surprise, actually, the camps we've used in the Maasai Mara, all of them have had amazing chefs, and I really didn't expect that. Yeah. First Purity at House in the Wild, then Godfrey, and now Raphael at Matty Coco. Real gems. I mean, I don't know where they find these people. You know, they're so dedicated, inventive. The quality of the food's been absolutely incredible. You know, like to a really high, surprisingly high standard. And that's in the middle of nowhere in the Maasai Mara. You know, I remember the words of Don, who's a veteran of several trips with us. He said last time,
the food is wonderful. The food is posh, okay? The food definitely is better than you get in most restaurants.
You know, that says everything you need. Mm-hmm. I love the chat around the table as well, whether that's excitement about what wildlife spectacles we've seen that day or just, you know, talking about photography or wildlife conversation. It's it means a lot.
So that did turn into a little bit of a rant, as I sort of suspected that it would. But yeah, you're right. I think I'll sort of bring that little rant to a close, I think, by, as you say, giving the chefs that we have on our safaris a very special mention. You know, they are absolutely wonderful. And they do so well preparing beautiful meals. They don't have huge kitchens, top-line equipment. And importantly, you know, they know that we don't stick to a timetable. But they're so incredibly accommodating, flexible, and they always do so well for us and our guests. So, yeah, big thank you to Raphael at Matty Coco. There's also Manasseh at Kia Kia in Umlani. And last but certainly not least, Kennedy in Tule Block in Botswana. So big thank you to you guys, chefs, just for being absolutely amazing and very, very accommodating of our sort of erratic timetables.
Yeah. I just find that the people involved in these trips are just genuinely just nice people as well.
Yeah. You know. Yeah, they're great. Yeah.
Okay, let's wrap this section up. We'll be continuing in episode 8, where we'll look at some of the logistical issues to consider when choosing a photography safari. And now, on to the super sexy subject of, drumroll, backups. Just heard the collective groan of the ether. It's one of those necessary evils on safari. I think you'd probably agree, Alan.
Absolutely. It's, you know, backups, it's a very dry subject, but it's also incredibly important. On a photography safari, you will have incredible memories. But, you know, your reason for being there really is the data contained on these tiny little memory cards. And it would be pretty devastating to lose photographs on a sort of once-in-a-lifetime, potentially a once-in-a-lifetime photography safari.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, occasionally things do go wrong and images can get lost. SD cards can get corrupted. I think it's pretty rare these days. Although, interestingly, literally just now, I was saying to Alan, I've never had a problem with corruption on an SD card. I put another card in his camera to record this section and it wouldn't read it. And I thought, for f***'s sake, you know. So, yeah.
I think the bleeper's going to get quite a good workout.
I think it is, yeah.
episode.
It is. So, you know, it's not paying rent. Anyway, and hard drives can die. Laptops can just stop working, you know, sometimes for no reason, but, you know. SSDs within laptops are usually more reliable these days, but not every laptop still has an SSD. Some of the, you know, the ones with the still with the spinning hard drives. But, you know, a laptop can just die in its entirety. So, for context, in my home office, in terms of backups, I've got two separate RAID arrays, which is a collection of hard drives, which makes one big drive, if you like. Each of them is about 80 terabytes of storage. It's just, you know, it's massive. It's a bit extreme. It's because I've got a huge quantity of video files, mainly, because most of my work is filmmaking these days. But, you know, it's an essential part, I think, of thinking about what would happen if something went wrong. I have my work on several hard drives, whether in the laptop or external, and each of those gets backed up. Both, you know, it stays on the drive it's on, but it also gets backed up to both drive arrays. That means I've got three copies of everything. When I had a separate office, I'd keep one of the backup arrays there. So if there was a fire or some other disaster in one place, then, or you got nicked or whatever, then there'd always be one working copy at least of everything. Now, you know, I'm not suggesting everybody should be as paranoid as me, but, you know, maybe a little bit paranoid is good.
Yeah, but, you know, when we've been away doing other projects like the Seabirds film and stuff, now, it's amazing because people will insure their cameras and their lenses, but then they don't really give as much consideration to the content that they create.
Yeah.
Now, when we've been away filming, those, you know, the flights, the hotels, the day rates that we were on, that costs a lot of money and we get a fee for that.
Yeah.
But people don't seem to give the content that's being created the same consideration.
I think it's like a
hidden
thing,
isn't
it?
How many times a day did we do backups and things in Norway when we were doing the Seabird stuff? Yeah. It was three, four times. We had to back everything up. It was more important than a camera insurance was the content.
Absolutely. Well, that's the thing. That's the IP. It's what you're there for. You know, if that goes, then what was the point of everything else?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's a, practically speaking, on safari, we always have to consider the size and weight of everything we bring. Alan and I both bring laptops, although I know not everybody likes to, but we do. We back up everything onto those laptops every night from the camera cards. So for people who don't like to bring laptops, I've seen people who will have a regime where every day they'll take the camera card from the camera and put that somewhere else, and then they'll put a new card in the camera, and that means that they've got one per day or whatever. And what that does is it cuts down on that idea that, you know, you've got an entire trip's worth of photos and that one card goes down and then that's it, it's fucked. You were right about the beep machine. I've gone completely off piste here, but anyway. It's also worth saying that a lot of cameras have two slots, so you can do a backup from one to the other simultaneously, you know, without even really thinking about it. So, you know, you could just have two enormous SD cards in the camera. Just make sure you don't lose those in a river, because then that's the whole thing gone. So for Safari backups, there are a load of portable USB drives or Thunderbolt drives, you know, and these are external drives that take their power from the USB connection itself. You don't have to have another cable plugging it into a wall outlet or whatever. They take their power directly through the cable. They're quite light compared with usual desktop hard drives, like the, you know, the quite big hard drives that are found in a PC, for example. For the portable ones, a 2 terabyte one isn't too expensive, maybe 65 quid, which is about $80 US at today's rates. A 4 terabyte one might be £100 or $125 or thereabouts. It's worth noticing that these hard drives still have spinning innards in them, so they can be a little bit fragile. Some are better at surviving than others when being knocked about. For example, the Lassie, I think that's how you pronounce it, Lassie. Rugged Range, they've got drop protection, for example. They've actually got extra sort of rubberizing stuff around them. Yeah. But to be honest, if you welly it against a brick wall, don't expect it to speak to you again. Yeah. If you can afford an SSD, then that is the ideal form of external backup device. These are essentially computer memory chips in a portable container.
It's like a giant camera memory card, really.
Yeah, exactly. Just with a cover on it, that makes them portable. They're lightweight, they're small, they have no moving parts, they're usually very, very fast as well compared to a normal spinning drive. The only downside is that they're more expensive. There had to be a downside, you know. They might be 2 to 3 times more expensive than spinning drives. So, it is a significant investment. But maybe you don't need 2 or 4 terabytes. Maybe you need just 1 or 0.5 terabyte. Depends how many photos you take. I've moved over to these entirely now for Safari because they're just small, light, fast, you know, just, the, you know, but really robust as well. Actually, that reminds me, I've just bought a Sony A9 Mark III. That's just come out and it shoots 120 raw frames a second. So I'm going to have to make sure I've got enough storage and backup space for all of that and maybe not be so heavy-handed on the shutter button. As for the software for backup, there are lots of different solutions, but to be honest, forget all of that. The simplest method when on Safari is literally just to copy the files every day onto an external backup, into a new folder, maybe with that day's date. No need to complicate things, just copy and paste, done. I often get into a routine where I'll quickly set the copy operation going as soon as I get back to camp and then go straight to the campfire for a drink and a chinwag with the guests. By the time I come back, the backup's done. Actually, Alan's off to the fire already for a beer, and I'm usually the second or third beer. Yeah, exactly. I'm going to back these things up before I get there. And you know, we've also got into the habit of doing like cross backups. So what we'll actually do is I'll back up my images on Alan's drive, and he'll do the same on mine. You know, belt and braces, or is that belt, braces, and hermetically sealed escape pod? You know, I don't know. The dimensioned paranoia.
You know, it's rather a dry subject, really. So much so that I'm going to open it here as I continue this. That's how dry it is. But you know, it's also very, very important. Yeah, it is a bit dull. And, you know, sometimes a little bit of paranoia or a bit of OCD is good. It keeps us on our feet.
Yeah.
Speaking of being kept on our feet, I'm just making sure this glass doesn't overflow. But, yeah, I usually do my backups last thing at night after a shower, and usually while I sort of imbibe upon a duty-free malt whiskey, and it sort of helps put me to sleep, really.
We should probably do a future podcast episode with which whiskies to buy.
Which whiskies to buy for safari. The ones that are the best value.
Yeah.
The smokiest malt whiskey Absolutely. You can find. So,
sorry.
Another beer over.
Excuse me.
So I use my laptop. I have two of these Lassie rugged hard drives. The SD card goes into the laptop of my card reader, and I make copies to both hard drives. I agree with what Khalil's just said absolutely completely. There are software solutions for syncing, but, you know, I prefer to use my Finder app, or if you're on Windows, just use Explorer or File Manager or whatever it's called these days. I create a folder for each day, maybe inside this, a folder for each camera, and I just copy and paste, you know. I can see the backup progressing. I know how many shots are on the card. I can visually check the folders I create on my hard drives that they contain the same number of files. And then that's it. Cards go back into the camera, reformat them. And next day, ready to use, ready to go again in the morning. I do know of a well-known hard drive manufacturer that included an SD card slot in their hard drive. So it could be used independently of a laptop. And I think the firmware would analyse what was on the card and would automatically back up anything new. Great in theory, but I also recall reading about some firmware issues and a lot of issues with users losing a lot of data. So, you know, the moral of the story is that automation, syncing, is all great, but you have to have absolute proven reliability if you're going to use it. I like to see it.
I like to have my own visual
confirmation that it's done. You know, content is king.
What you might be referring to is I used to have one of those hard drives, and it was in its own case. It had a screen and it had an SD card. I can't remember what it was called. It was quite convenient
until it broke. I do actually know exactly the hard drive manufacturer I'm talking about, but okay. It could be potentially quite libelous.
Okay. Don't buy them the shit.
I think it's fixed now, but we better not mention it.
Fair enough.
So something else I must add to this is, do not, when you're out in places like Africa or anywhere in the world, it doesn't really matter if you're in Africa, don't always think you're going to be able to rely on the cloud as part of your backup regime.
Yeah.
Your lodge or your camp, it probably will have Wi-Fi, but it is Africa Wi-Fi. It's fine for a bit of email, a bit of social media, a bit of messaging, etc., but it's unlikely to be fast enough and reliable to be shifting gigabytes of data.
Definitely not. Anyway, I mean, you know, it's not going to be cloudy in Africa anymore when we go.
Yeah, I know a couple of people who've tried this despite my advice prior to leaving, and yes, predictably it has absolutely failed. I've had to step in and create backups of their work on my hard drives and then sort it out remotely when I get back to the UK. It's not a massive problem. I'm most pleased if I can sort of help somebody out. But it also means that they have to wait until I return to the UK to receive their photographs, which is, you know, not ideal. Lastly, you know, really check your hard drives before you travel. Make sure that they work. Make sure they're formatted correctly. Make sure they've got space on them and they are actually sort of ready to use.
Yeah.
Don't bring them out in the middle of the wilderness still sealed in their delivery packaging to realise that there's a problem. And again, this is, I speak from experience, not my own, I must say, but it's another example that I've had to deal with. Again, always happy to help solve problems with people, but stuff like this can take up a huge amount of time, and it's stuff that can just be so easily avoided.
Yeah,
there are various solutions. Just make sure it works accurately, it works reliably, and you actually do your backups. Always have at least two copies of everything. If one fails, seek help.
Yeah, totally with you. I've got some news about raptor decline across Africa. Credit to The Guardian for this one, for picking up a paper in Nature, Ecology and Evolution Journal. In fact, that there's there's been a population crash across Africa. I was quite surprised at this, well, the extent of it, I think, of most raptors like eagles and goshawks and so on, because they, you know, due to the conversion of wild areas to farmland and deliberate poisonings as well, you know, vultures are included in this decline, even though they're not always considered a raptor, but, you know, these top predators and the cleanup crew are an essential part of the ecosystem they inhabit. And if they're gone, it could, you know, it could have unknown consequences. There was an instance that they cited in India where some of the vultures had been basically decimated, and the local population, I think it was dogs, it meant that there was more of a spread of rabies because the vultures weren't doing the cleanup operation that they were supposed to do.
Yeah. Yeah, the dogs were prospering, feral dogs were prospering because of the abundance of food, because the vultures weren't there.
Yeah, I mean, I hesitated to put that little bit in, and in fact, I've kind of gone off script slightly, but the reason I wasn't sure about putting that in is it's a very specific example. I think it's important to remember with these sort of things that you can't really know. If the top predators go from an ecosystem, you can't know what the effect's going to be.
Absolutely. Definitely.
You know, when I first started reading through this report, well, it was the article, and I thought, well, it's thankfully, at least, you know, it's not so bad within the protected areas like the reserves. Mm-hmm. We see loads of birds of prey, you know, fish eagles, battlers, goshawks, vultures and so on. Unfortunately, these birds of prey are only a little bit better off than outside the protected zone. So there is a protection effect, but they're still, you know, declining massively.
Yeah, I read in the same article that there was 42 raptor species studied, and 90% of those species had experienced declines, with, you know, more than 2/3 showing evidence of becoming globally threatened.
Yeah,
and you know, raptors—they're an important part of the ecosystem. They're the cleanup crew. They are hunters. They are predators. So it was quite alarming news, just to the severity of it, more than anything else, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Right, now it's time for the second in Alan's series of Amazing Wildlife Wonders. That's another drum roll. Second in the episode. In the last episode, we talked about the myth and the truth behind elephant graveyards. So now it's just the second in that series, and we're going to start with the same caveat as previously. We're all in a continuous learning process when it comes to natural history. Ecology and zoology are in a perpetual state of learning and evaluation, so that, you know, what's discussed now and generally accepted as correct could in future be absolutely debunked.
Yeah, it certainly could. It's about what is known based upon current understanding and the evidence and the research that we've got. So this is a bit of a two-parter, actually, and both parts are all about democracy. Now, Khalil, tell me what everybody knows about the foundations of democracy.
Oh, well, that's easy. As everybody knows, the foundation of modern democracy emerged in ancient Greece, with Cleisthenes and Pericles playing crucial roles. Cleisthenes introduced transformative reforms in the 6th century BCE. He empowered ancient Athenian citizens in decision-making. Later, during the Golden Age of Athens, Pericles further refined this democratic system. Together, their visionary contributions are credited as laying the foundations for the democratic ideals that have transcended time and borders, shaping various forms of democratic governance worldwide.
Yeah, so everybody knows that. But what if I was to tell you that animals have been practicing democratic decision making, and have probably been doing so long before old Cleanse's knees and Pericles. Let's look at an iconic species, an absolute wildlife photographer's favourite, it has to be said. One where we have left whatever we are doing, wherever we are, photographing, observing, eating, drinking, when we get word, wild dogs. Okay, often known as a painted dog, a cape hunting dog, they are superb to watch as they move so efficiently and quickly in packs. You need to either be very lucky to find them, or what is preferable, you know, have a pretty good communications network in place to track them. And if they slow down, or better, stop for some interaction and rest while you're with them, well, they're just epic to see and of course to photograph. Now, for the avoidance of doubt, we are talking about a wild canine species. It's a formidable pack predator. We're not talking about a bunch of feral spaniels or beagles or whatever escaped from the local kennels.
I've got this idea of a lot of Labradors bounding across.
Feral Labradors and collies and things like
fantastic,
that.
Fantastic, you know. Yeah.
Lassie, rabid Lassie.
A bunch of Pekingese.
Yeah. So, according to researchers, a democratic process exists within packs of wild dogs. Now, when it comes to decision-making, we raise a hand, and I'm just busy holding this beer, so I'm going to have a drink of it. We maybe put an X in a box, in a ballot or a vote, or we shout yay or nay, you know.
Hey.
However, wild dogs have been observed adopting a sort of particularly nasal approach to democracy. When it's time for a pack of wild dogs to determine whether to move on, the pack engages in a bout of sneezing to see... to see how I am serious, yeah, I'm not joking. They engage in a bout of sneezing to see how many members of the pack are ready to move on, and they agree it's time to move on. So the more sneezes or audible rapid nasal exhalations, as it's actually defined by the researchers, then the more likely it is that the pack will set out on their next hunt. However, dare I say it, it's just like our own democratic system. It's absolutely flawed. It's not all sneezers. Sneezers hold equal representation. It's actually been observed that during these bouts of democratic sneezing, that the final results were heavily influenced when more dominant pack members either initiated the nasal... They either initiated the nasal ballot or they contributed a sneeze or two, whereas lower ranking dogs in the pack had to sneeze more times to get their votes counted. I mean, come on.
So, democracy by snot then?
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. Well, it is to me. I mean, I love this stuff. I mean, not the snot and the sneezing, but just the whole sort of the way that animals do things and the reason that they do things and why it's different to us. You know, I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Voting by sneezing or rapid nasal exhalations, whichever way you want to put it. It's great, man.
We should try that in the pub next time.
Yeah,
it's like, round is it?
And
just like decide. He's got one before, but do it by snorting and snotting. Okay, so part two of Mammal Democracy will return. Honestly,
no,
I mean, what
snot.
There's no snot next to it. Okay,
no.
Episode 8 will contain no snot.
Snot's
no
funny.
Phlegm.
Snot's funny.
It's not funny at all.
Right. Howard, we have a question to the podcast. Howard from Dublin has emailed us to say, in a previous episode, actually episode 6, we referred to cheetah cubs as honey badger impersonators. Now, why is this? Well, yeah, we certainly did.
Those were very, very special experiences, 6 little honey badger impersonators.
So, honey badgers have a reputation for being incredibly fearless, very ferocious, tenacious mammals. They will literally take on lions, leopards, and absolutely anything that threatens them.
Feisty little buggers.
They are, you know. I'm sure they were sort of evolved in biker or something. I've seen videos.
Must side in Manchester.
I've seen videos of them taking on groups of lions. They really do epitomise the saying that the best method of defence is to attack. For their size, they have very, very thick and importantly, very rubbery, loose skin. So it means that if a predator such as a lion or a leopard gets one of them by the neck, they're very adept at being able to turn their heads right around and deliver quite a significant retaliatory bite with their own very powerful jaws. Incidentally, there's also evidence to suggest that just like mongoose or...
Mongooses.
Not mongoose, not mongai, mongooses. Not mongooses. Mongoose. Snake venom may be unable to fully bond to their blood cells to have an effect. And I think their blood contains some sort of protein that binds to venom, rendering it so much less lethal or even ineffective. They're also reported to be quite a significant contributor to the transmission of rabies, incidentally. Hmm. Have you ever seen honey badgers?
Not in the wild, well, not alive anyway, but I've actually seen a dead one in Zimbabwe. We were driving to one of the reserves, I think it was Hwangi National Reserve in Zimbabwe, and the driver stopped to look at some roadkill, and we were like, what's that? And right. But it wasn't normal roadkill, it was a honey badger. And I guess this one wasn't quite as feisty as its brethren, but
take on a Land Rover.
Exactly. Me versus a Land Cruiser. It's like, yeah.
It's not really from biker after all.
No, yeah. Well, it might have been, but run over by 2.5 tons of Land Cruiser. My abiding memory of that encounter was, it wasn't so much that it was a honey badger, it was the fact that when we got out and had a look at it and we started photographing it, you know, as you do, a bit of gore, it was that there was a butterfly drinking its blood. And I was like, that's really? Odd, you know. It's, what part of the ecosystem is this? You know, I thought, you know, you think,
Sanguivorous butterfly.
Yeah, you tend to think of butterflies as these lovely sort of little fluttery creatures and everything. And I looked it up later on, and it's because there are minerals in the blood that they need. And I think, to be honest, butterflies will go for anything that's nutritious.
Right.
It's
I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. It was quite a shock, I guess, and part of the cycle of life that I really wasn't expecting.
Yeah, so I've seen them very fleetingly in the wild in Timbervati, but unfortunately I've never actually had an opportunity to photograph them. Years ago I was in some very dubious wildlife rehabilitation centre in South Africa. You know these places where there's a lot of people wandering around like a zoo with very little evidence of any rehabilitation going on. Hmm. And there was a honey badger, supposedly a rescue animal, and it was just doing what honey badgers do best. It was
they're sitting there saying, yeah, come on, I'll take you all on.
Yeah, absolutely trying and sort of willing to take the world on. They're so tenacious, it's incredible. I can't actually recall seeing any of them in Kenya or Botswana, but yeah, they are present. So, honey badger impersonators.
Yeah, so the reason we mentioned this is that cheetah cubs have a thick sort of silvery grey fur line down their back. It's reckoned that this fur may form a sort of camouflage that sort of imitates the look of a honey badger that would help deter predators. I mean, you know, if I saw that, I'd be like, yeah, no, maybe move on to something else. So lions, hyenas and eagles would just not approach them because they,
It takes a pretty desperate predator, even a leopard, to... I mean, they do. Leopard will take a honey badger, but it's got to be... It's like a porcupine. It's got to be
very hungry. Yeah. So once you know what to look for, it's interesting. This sort of this line of fur down the back of the neck on a cheetah cub, it's quite obvious when you've seen it, and it's an easy way of telling them from the adults, which don't have that. Last year, we photographed and filmed an adult teacher.
Teacher,
yeah. Well, she was teaching her cubs, I suppose.
I'm sure I've seen that film on porn. We'll have to cut that out.
Big cat porn. Last year, we photographed and filmed an adult cheetah called Rasasi, successfully hunting a gazelle. You might have seen the video. We've spoken about this before in a previous episode. And as soon as Rasasi had pinned down that gazelle, we spotted her cubs running in from cover because they'd been hiding. Obviously, they're at risk while the hunt's going on, but they go and hide. She must give them some kind of signal, I think. To
unless they visualise it, they go. You know, I'm not sure.
You could say, remember, they sort of came behind a termite mound, and I don't know whether she gave them a signal or they just instinctively understood to hide themselves.
I think it's instinctive.
Yeah, it must be. So once she'd killed the gazelle, they then came running back, and you know, it was just lovely to see. They came running back and they just looked like little honey badgers against the savannah. And you could see why they would just look.
Absolutely.
That's why we referred to them as little honey badger impersonators.
I'm pretty sure I remember sitting in the vehicle watching and as soon as the Rassasi took down the gazelle, I looked to see where the cubs were.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure my first instinct was, oh, honey badgers.
Yeah.
But no, it was the cubs running forward. Yeah.
I wonder if a honey badger would actually take, you know, hyenas come in and they'll take kills off other animals. I don't know if honey badgers would.
I don't know. I'm not sure.
It's not that kind of thing, but it's
they would.
It's more, I think honey badgers are just one of those things. If you're a predator, you just think twice about taking them on, because they're just like, yeah, I'll have you.
They're very, very defensively tenacious.
Yeah. So that is also why I will be sporting a Mohican when we go back to the Maasai Mara.
Great Mohican.
Great Mohican. Yeah.
Cross your back or your head.
Yeah.
Yes, that's something I would love to see. Well, I wouldn't actually love to see that at all.
Don't tempt me, I will.
So another question to the podcast, and this one comes from Robin, who I met at WWT Martin Mier Northwest Bird Fair, clearly opening yet another beer. When I was there, I was down at the Bird Fair working with Fujifilm UK towards the end of last year. And Robin said she has recently read a post on some sort of online group about wildlife photography, and specifically about blood, guts and gore. Should wildlife photographers censor potentially sensitive images? My very, very quick answer is, unsurprisingly, a resounding no. I do think there's nothing wrong with perhaps giving people a bit of notice that what they're going to see. So actually, if we do make it to YouTube on this episode of the podcast, and if you are sensitive to a bit of blood, guts and gore in wildlife photography, then, you know, yeah, consider this your warning.
Oh, well, in that case, I'll dig out my butterfly feeding on a honey badger roadkill blood image. Okay, on that note, let's talk about some blood and guts. So the debate about blood and gore in wildlife photography revolves around ethics and the balance between capturing the raw reality of nature and respecting the sensibility of viewers. I tend not to really worry too much about people's sensibilities, but I'm aware that people are a bit more squeamish than others, and I don't just put shocking images out there for the sake of it. I think that's the key. There has to be purpose. I've no problem depicting the harsh and sometimes brutal aspects of wildlife, you know, including predator-prey interactions and images of animals feeding on prey. That's just what happens in nature, you know, and it feels to me that to sanitize that just wouldn't be telling the truth. Having said that, there are certain times when it's perhaps not, it's just not appropriate. Showing an eviscerated zebra's guts to a child is probably going to give them nightmares, or maybe depends on the child. I might not have been so bothered. Also, I'd caution against using graphic images simply to shock rather than to educate or show real wildlife behaviour. I'm not saying I'm right, that's just my take on things. I don't like the idea of censorship of an image, if it's showing genuine animal behaviour. And it can be powerful without being sensationalised, you know. What's your take on that?
In past episodes, we've mentioned photographing behaviour and animal relationships. We've talked about commensalism, mutualism, parasitism, for example. Now, perhaps the ultimate relationship between species is predation. It's probably the very heartbeat that manages and maintains the health of the habitat and the ecosystem. And predation is just such an important part of natural history.
Yeah.
Do I feel that photographing the demise of an animal is glorifying it? No, not really. But just as we said earlier at the beginning when we were talking about Kasaru, wild animals in places like the Mara, Kruger, Serengeti, wherever, you know, they will die.
Yeah.
And they will die as a result of predation, or they will die of natural causes, and then they will be scavenged. That's life in these ecosystems, you know. To censor this reality is just not conducive to the honesty and the integrity of natural history photography.
Yeah.
To feel sorry for a predated animal, I get that. It's a natural human emotion.
Yeah, it's understandable.
It's one born out of this anthropomorphism, this anthropomorphism word again. But, you know, the predation of a gazelle by a cheetah mother, it's so important for her and the survival of her cubs. And then it's important for the hyenas. and then it's important for the jackals, and then it's important for the vultures, right down to the termites. Yeah. You know, there's a whole ecosystem here. Really, I think it's all about perspective.
Yeah.
It's perspective is important. Which perspective? I mean, you know, the lobsters in the Titanic kitchen were quite pleased when that sort of when that iceberg sort of fucked up. I'm
sure that's the most it was like, wait, it's cold here.
I'm not sure if that's the most appropriate analogy, but it is about perspective, isn't it? You know? Anyway.
I think I think to me it's about why you are showing that image, if it's to shock or sensationalize or to just try and get some reaction for nothing other than just like its own sake. There's nothing in that, you know. But, you know, equally, whilst some people might be a bit more squeamish than others, I think it's important to realize that, you know, we as humans are kind of divorced from this idea that, you know, life has to go on in the circle of life. And it's quite brutal in some aspects, you know.
We've seen it. We've witnessed it.
Yeah. It's just how it is.
Mm-hmm. And it, the clue's in the name. It's natural history.
Yeah.
This is what happens, you know.
Yeah, definitely. So, what is in episode 8?
Lots.
Loads. How do you know? We haven't written it yet. again, an episode of two parts, or an episode of part twos, rather. Part two of Choosing a Safari and part two of Alan's Mammal Democracy.
It's no sneezing involved.
No. Hope not. I've had enough of the snot. Camera maintenance in the field, which is rather important on safari.
Absolutely is.
We're also going to go back to basics and talk about some of the camera setups and settings we use. And we'll kick off with what's probably the most important thing about photography, and that's exposure. You know, how bright is the image? What do you need to consider for getting a well-exposed image? And there's lots of things to consider with that. We may also have a book review. We haven't had one this episode, and that's because we've rambled on for far too long anyway.
I mentioned a book earlier on. I made a couple of quotes from Dave Varty's Circle of Life, the Growth of the Londolozi Reserve. It's a good book. So I think that could be our book review.
Excellent.
Yeah, it's enshrined now.
Well, we've said it, so we're going to do it now.
I think that's it for now. So thank you very much for listening, and we shall return in episode 8.
Indeed. So if you want any more information about safaris, go to africanphotographysafaris.com, and we'll see you in the next one. Ta-ta.
Cheers.
Cheers. It's a wrap.